From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And today's show is about art and islands, Chris.
That's right. Our first guest this morning will be Tom Schaub. He is the Vice President of Business Development with Deco Art, a company out of Kentucky that makes acrylic paint, among other things. But the catch is that 70% of each gallon of acrylic paint produced is reclaimed. They literally take discarded acrylic paint, remix it, and reclaim it for both interior and exterior use. We'll speak with Tom about how the process works and how much paint is reclaimed each year.
And then in the second part of the show, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Christina Gerhardt about her book, Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean.
Right. As the world faces rising sea levels due to climate change, many countries are making contingency plans to relocate populations to higher ground. But what happens when you live on an island where there is no higher ground, or on a coral atoll where very soon there might be no ground left at all?
Dr. Gerhardt weaves together essays, maps, art, and poetry to provide a greater understanding of island nations in a warming world. We'll have that discussion in the second part of the show.
Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. And joining us in the first part of the show is Tom Schaub. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Let me know if I'm not. Tom, you're the Vice President of Business Development with the company Deco Art, and you're here to talk ostensibly about acrylic paints and Deco Art's acrylic paints, which are actually partially reclaimed. Tom, thank you so much for joining Claire and myself on This Green Earth this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I look for any opportunity to talk about our new Deco Earth paint brand, so thanks for having me.
Yeah, and first, in our research, we were coming across the terms Deco Art and Deco Earth. I want to make sure we get the company names right. Is there a difference?
Yeah, so Deco Art is the name of the overall company, and we have many brands under that umbrella. Deco Earth is the new reclaimed acrylic paint brand that we've recently released. And the Deco Earth paint brand is the one that we are utilizing reclaimed house paint to produce it.
Okay, so it's Deco Earth. Let's start here. Tell us, what is acrylic paint? Typically, not Deco Earth acrylic paint, we'll get to that in a second, but if I go to the store and the paint or a hobby shop and I buy acrylic paint, what are the ingredients in acrylic paint?
Yeah, so basically, when you're looking at an acrylic paint, it's all we make are water-based acrylics. And acrylics, you have a binder in there, you have other additives that, depending on the attributes of the paint, you'll have preservatives in there. You'll have rheology that you put in there for the viscosity, and you know, that kind of stuff. We do not deal in any kind of oils or anything like that in our facility here in Kentucky.
Right. So acrylics, like you say, they're water based, but they do contain a lot of chemicals, and those chemicals can find their origin, let's say, in a barrel of oil.
Correct. I mean, you know, there's, you know, they're inherently acrylic. It's inherently has plastic in it.
Yeah.
Yes, to answer your question.
Okay. So, but the good thing about acrylic paint versus typical, let's say, oil-based paints is that when you're done with the can, so to speak, and there's still residues of paint left in acrylic paint can, that can be discarded with your household waste. At least that's what we're told here by our local recycling facility.
Yeah, typically, you know, if you're getting rid of oil paint, the water will evaporate and dry out. It'll become more of a solid, or you can add things like cat litter and things like that that will dry it out, and then it becomes a solid and then is able to be disposed of.
Mm. Okay. All right. Now let's turn to Deco Earth acrylic paint. that has a percentage of it that is actually reclaimed. Describe to us what this paint is.
Yeah, so there are 27 colors in the DecoEarth line. Across those 27 colors, we're averaging over 70% reclaimed house paint. And it happens to be a very premium product, so it performs better than our signature brand, which is Americana. Americana is placed in, if you've been in Michael's or Joanne, you see those 2 ounce jars that are in the paint aisle. Mm-hmm. That's the product that we have. So what makes it so great is, again, we're starting with a very high-end paint product, which is produced by, you know, large paint companies like Sherwin-Williams and Behr. So they produce quality stuff. So we're taking that, we're reclaiming it, and it gives us a product that has incredible coverage. It has a very nice, creamy consistency, so it flows off the brush nicely. You're able to mix it and create a whole spectrum of new colors. You can get a nice color wheel with your secondary and tertiary colors. Just a gorgeous palette and also very durable. So it just is a really premium product.
So what is the process that is happening here to collect that paint? Mm-hmm. And what's your relationship to these paint companies? How does that work?
Yeah, so we're partnering with a company in California called Encore. Encore has been working on reclaiming house paint for about 5 years before we started working with them about 2 years ago. The way this works is there are paint care states in the United States. These paint care states have places where people can turn in their house paint. Typically, they're paint retailers, so that people will bring their unused paint to there. That's where they're collected. And then some of that paint is getting to the Encore facility in California in Sacramento, where it is actually hand sorted. They will discard anything that's not labeled or is hazardous is immediately discarded. Then they take the light colors, bring those together, and send those through a filtration system and clean them up. They'll add things to them to bring them back into specs, like, you know, rheology modifiers, checking pH balance to make sure that it doesn't get too low, which will make the paint unstable. Depending on each batch is different, so the testing, there may be additives that need to be put in there, like preservatives that I mentioned earlier and things like that. Every batch is different, so, you know, that is a bit challenging for this process.
So this was, keep going.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say that then Encore does is once they send batches to us in our facility in Kentucky, and what we do with those batches is, you know, there'll be a batch like, for example, a blue batch. Mm-hmm. We'll take that blue batch and we'll make all the blues in our range of this palette. So there's also like a red batch, and so we'll make all of the reds out of that batch. There's quite a bit of work that we have to do to it when it gets to our facility in Kentucky, but we're able to do that. And not only do that, but able to make sure that it's within our, you know, quality standards. Because one of the things that's important in our category is that if you, for example, purchased Berry Red today, that you can purchase it 3 years from now and know that it's going to be the exact same product, the same color, the same viscosity, the same performance. So that is very important to us in the premium quality of the product that we're able to produce.
So when you decided to go down this path and provide something that was a little bit more friendly to the earth, was this a consumer demand? Was this a company action that you decided that if we're going to be in this business, that we should step up as a business and do our best for the planet? Mm.
Yeah, really two factors. Number one, and it's the simplest one to answer, is we care. Mm-hmm. We care about what's happening to our planet. We care about our impact as a company and what's going on. So we've been looking, I've been with the company for 32 years, and we've been looking for some way to come up with a more sustainable or more environmentally friendly, friendly product to provide our customers over these years, it had to have really two things. Number one, it had to have a real true impact. We didn't want some kind of marketing spin. We wanted something that was really going to make a difference. And the second thing is that it had to be, you know, a premium product, like I was mentioning. You know, we didn't want to put out something that, hey, this is environmentally friendly, but it's not necessarily up to the standards that we've produced as a company in the past.
Right.
So that was the first thing. The second thing is, as you kind of alluded to, we know it's important to our customers, especially our younger creatives. You know, there's a lot of data out there that tells us that they are very concerned about this. Nielsen had and there's plenty of stats here, but one of them is Nielsen surveyed, and 75% of millennials, for example, will change their purchasing decision in favor of a more environmentally friendly product. Hmm. So we knew it was out there. We do a lot of research on our on the creative category, and knew that was something that, you know, our customers are asking us for as well.
We're speaking with Tom Schaub. He is the Vice President of Business Development with the company Deco Art, and we're talking about that company's brand of reclaimed acrylic paint, Deco Earth brand of acrylic paint. Tom, in your promotional material, it says 70 million gallons of, I'm guessing, acrylic-based paint is wasted each year. Otherwise, wasted meaning thrown away, discarded. What kind of impact is Deco Art having with its Deco Earth paint?
Well, obviously, we are just launching this product, so we're making a small contribution to trying to reclaim this product. But the paint care states that I mentioned before, they've collected over almost 70 million gallons of unused paint. So as we build this brand and we get this more people using it, our impact can be greater and greater. It's important to us. That's why we're trying to get the message out about this paint line, is to hopefully make a bigger impact of what's happening. And you know, the stat that the EPA put out is, you know, there's 750 million gallons of house paint purchased every single year in the US, which is a staggering number. And so, as you mentioned, 70 to 75 million gallons are not used and will eventually head to the waste stream.
Yeah. That kind of remind me of something that you said about the sources of this paint, literally from individual paint users. But I was curious, does, say, Sherwin-Williams or Behr, as the two companies you mentioned, do they have, say, off-spec paint or paint that doesn't meet, match their qualities? Would you be, or would Encore be taking paint like that?
Yeah, so anything like post-production that doesn't meet their specs, that is another avenue for gathering that paint and then reclaiming it and repurposing it. So that is definitely something that happens and that we are looking at as well. We don't currently have a partnership with any of those major house paint companies, but it is something that, you know, we're looking at this as our first steps. And you know, we know this isn't perfect, and it's not gonna, you know, it's not where we want to be, but it's a first step to trying to make a difference, and trying to lead the industry in our category, especially in looking at a more sustainable way to provide creative products to our customers.
And when you're talking sustainability and businesses in communities, local businesses, national businesses, international businesses, why do you think it's important for people to be leaders in this space? Why do you think it's important for Deco Art to be a leader? And then how would you challenge other businesses maybe to get in step with that?
Yeah.
I mean, for the reasons that we talked about with the waste that's going into our landfills and just the, you know, how the population of the world today and all of the materials that we're creating, it's just, you know, we all want to leave the planet in a better place for our kids and our grandkids and generations to come. So I think that as a leader, one of the paint leaders in our category, we felt, you know, it was that we should try to come up with something that could show that this can be done. It's not necessarily easy, and it takes some work to figure out, but it can be done. And again, this is just the first steps of doing it. Something that I didn't mention earlier is part of creating this full cycle is that we are partnering with another company. We're in testing stages right now, but have done several successful tests, is taking the empty jars of paint, and even some that have paint in them, and taking it to their facility where they grind it up into pellets, and they're actually putting those pellets into asphalt, which then they're using to pave highways and parking lots. We've done a test with one of the bourbon distilleries here in Kentucky, did their parking lot. It actually makes the asphalt cheaper and improves the performance of the asphalt. So, you know, again, it's another thing where it's making a difference and it's actually providing a premium product. So we're excited about that. And looking at other things like biodegradable pallets and things like that, that we can add to this Deco Earth brand.
You know, one thing I always wondered about, you know, you go buy a can, a gallon of paint. It comes in the same metal-based can. I always thought, why don't we sell paint the same way we buy, why don't we buy paint in the same way we buy our laundry detergent?
Like
in
fulfilled
plastic.
Style?
Well, I know it's plastic, but it's a more pourable type of cylinder or container. Is there, I know this is maybe a little bit off target, but are there companies looking at alternative ways of containing paint instead of that classic centuries old idea of in a metal can?
Well, our product is actually in a plastic container that has some recycled content in it, and it's also recyclable. We don't produce any paints right now in a metal can. That's more of the DIY market, where we're talking about house paints and things like that. But I do know that, you know, we pay attention to what the latest technology is going on. And I know companies like Coca-Cola have a plant-based plastic container that they've put out on the market, and it seems to be performing very well. So there's a lot of innovation that's going on in packaging, and it's pretty exciting stuff. So we're hoping that, again, this is the, you know, the 2.0 or the 3.0 version of where we're going with this. But we're paying close attention to the innovation that's happening in packaging.
Right. And to be clear, that when we were talking about all these acrylic paints, these are, at least the paints I got mailed to me, sent to me, were for painting. This is
for artists.
Artist painting, not exterior house paint.
Correct. You know, our core group is arts and crafts. You know, and paint goes a long way when you're doing that. So our typical size jar is a 2 ounce jar of paint, and that goes a long way. We have a lot of colors in our paint lines, typically, so we don't require artists or crafters to have to mix. And that's kind of one of the keys to our market is, you know, you don't need a gallon of it. It's just, you know, it would be wasted if, you know, it take for a long time to go through that as an arts and crafts person.
Right. All right. Last minute, we got to wrap up. Hey, the only reason we have you on air is because somebody in your marketing department mailed me a box of paints and brushes.
Chris, the aspiring artist.
Yeah, and I started painting.
Oh, he is showing me, for listeners, because you can't see. He is showing me
a
really
painting.
Beautiful painting of a sailboat.
A little landscape.
And it has beautiful green trees and like very layered colors in in your waterway.
Thank you very much. We'll talk more about that.
Impressive.
But Tom, kudos to whoever sent that to me, because I didn't ask for it. So that's why you're on air this morning. I'm glad you are, because the paints are great. They are sold at, like you say, Michael's or Hobby Lobby or stores like that?
Or online, yeah.
Yeah, online.
Yeah, so let me clarify that. So this particular brand is not placed in retail yet. It will be going into retail stores soon, and we'll be definitely making everyone aware of that online on our website at decoart.com. You can purchase these on decoart.com, or they're also available on Amazon. If you look up the brand Deco Earth, you'll find the product there as well. But we'll be in a lot of different retail outlets here soon, and we're excited about that, and hopefully people go out there and look for it.
All right, Tom Schaub, Vice President of Business Development with the company Deco Art, talking about Deco Earth paints. Tom, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and thank you so much for what Deco Art and Deco Earth are doing.
Yes, we love to hear where companies are stepping up to the plate, because I do believe that it could be a ripple effect when you talk about listening to the consumers. And we do know that we do have a lot of people, Chris, in my age as well, very concerned about the planet, but there is a younger set that they want to make sure that the planet is healthy for them throughout their lives.
Wasteful.
So, yes, we appreciate what you're doing.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for having me. I love to talk about it and get the word out. So I appreciate it. And thanks for the kind comments about it. We really believe it's a great product.
All fantastic. Right. Thank
thanks,
you.
Thanks, Tom.
And we are now turning our attention to the islands, and we will be speaking with Dr. Christina Gerhardt, who has written a book called Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. Christina is also a senior fellow at the University of California, Berkeley. Christina, first, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for the invitation to join you, Claire and Chris. It's great to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm excited to dive into the book, and I have so many questions for you. But first of all, I wanted you to give us a little bit of a background on yourself, and then we'll get into this really unique perspective of this book. But first, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks for the question, Claire. I bring to this book, Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean, two perspectives. I have worked since 2009 covering the annual UN climate negotiations, and that's a really important thread contributing to the book. I wanted to bring the voices of frontline communities to a broad readership. That writing has been published in The Guardian, The Nation, Orion, Sierra, other venues. And then I'm also an academic, so I'm Lear Chair of Comparative Literature at Clark University starting this fall, helping to build up their climate school. And in that capacity, teaching the environmental humanities, which is basically how fields in the humanities, literature, art, film, whatever, how they engage the climate crisis. In that way, we think a lot about climate communications too. So basically, this book is really involving a lot of thinking about climate communications.
Absolutely. And you weave together different ways in which you approach this. And you had talked about environmental studies and humanities, but you also bring in cartography, geography, there's poetry, and then also this very distinct perspective from islanders. So can you talk about this approach that you started with kind of those three different ways in which you are describing sea level rise and sea change?
Yeah, thanks. I have 49 islands in the book Sea Change. Most but not all are preceded by maps, and most but not all are followed by poems by the islanders themselves. The maps were created by cartographer Molly Roy. She's a wonderful cartographer who worked on this book. Also some of Rebecca Solnit's atlases, if your listeners are familiar with those. And I weave together these different approaches because covering the UN climate negotiations and thinking about what methods best reach a broader readership, I thought about the fact that not everybody's going to sit down on a weekend and read a scientific report. Of course, a lot of your listeners listening to this specific show might, but not everybody is going to do that. And so I thought, you know, something that's a bit more playful, like really literally I wanted to do a coffee table book that made the whole thing pretty and enticing for people to want to engage. I call it the spoonful of sugar approach to a really grim topic, right?
Yeah.
Mm. And so can you describe to us first how sea level rise works, and then maybe the perspective of islanders, maybe how it's different than how we have been perhaps taught here.
Yeah, so sea level rise, in terms of how it works, it has two main sources. And I open the book with Greenland, the world's largest island, specifically to illustrate this. The two main sources are the melt of land ice or glaciers in the Arctic and the Antarctic, so at the poles. Mm-hmm. And as your listeners might know, the temperatures in the Arctic are atypically hot. You get a lot of reports this time of year of how off the charts they are. When you hear that, you should think sea level rise, mm-hmm. among many other things, right? The situation of the polar bears, et cetera, but sea level rise is a direct impact there. So the melt at the poles is one source. The other source is thermal expansion, which means when waters are hotter, they take up more space. So again, we're hearing a lot of reports about the astronomical off the charts temperatures, not only of air, of course, this week, you know, heading to places east of here from San Francisco, where I'm phoning into you from. But when people hear about ocean temperatures having that increased heat in them, they should think about thermal expansion, which is sea level rise, right? And so those are the two sources, the melt at the poles and then the thermal expansion. I start with Greenland because it's one of the sources, as I mentioned, but I also have in that chapter Inupiaq poet Akaniviana in conversation with a Marshall Islander halfway around the globe in the middle of the Pacific. And they're talking about how the melt in Greenland impacts the Marshall Islands. I wanted to center indigenous voices. So I start with two women, indigenous women, and this gets into your second question about perspectives. I think the voices of islanders, which are predominantly indigenous for the Pacific and predominantly, but not exclusively, Black for the Caribbean, are really, and those are the two main clusters of islands, I think. Of the 49, about 20 are in the Pacific and about 20 are in the Caribbean. Mm. I think it's really important to center their voices because they are the frontline communities that are experiencing the effects of sea level rise, which is one of many climate crisis effects, obviously. And they're bearing the brunt of it, but they have done the least to contribute to fossil fuel increased CO2 emissions, right? The global north, we in the global north are the largest producers of these CO2 emissions. I think islanders on average have produced a negligible amount of like 1% of CO2 emissions. So it is really nations in the global north, and especially the fossil fuel companies, right? The big five that are located in the north. And those are the entities that need to be held accountable. Whether you go with the nation approach, holding nations accountable that are bigger producers to, you know, transition to renewables, use less fossil fuels, or you try to hold the big oil companies accountable, which will, you know, there's a lot of new legal movement trying to do that too.
And historically speaking, you dive a little bit deeper into what the history of these islands are. And can you share some of these discoveries about timelines specifically?
Yeah, thanks for focusing on the timelines. So the history, like the poetry, like the art, is part of trying to make the story more human. There's been a lot of studies that have been conducted that, well, first off, we should acknowledge that people learn differently, right? Some people are visual learners, some people are more text-based learners. And there have been studies that have been done with regard to the climate crisis specifically, that facts and figures are not the best way to reach, or the only way to reach audiences. And so what does that mean? That means, you know, narratives become really important, or the art is a really helpful way, again, from the vantage point of islanders, of humanizing and visualizing this story. But there's another reason why I took this approach, this interdisciplinary approach. I refer to it sometimes as a symphony or a chorus of voices. And that is because I started teaching at the University of Hawaii over a decade ago, and I just wrapped up there, and I'm moving to the East Coast for this new position at Clark University. And my decade of living in the Pacific has taught me so much about Pacific indigenous cosmologies from different islands. And they don't really rent asunder the sciences and the arts the way that we are taught to do at university, say, right? By which I mean their poetry will be poetry, but will also be political. The Hawaiian founding, cosmology myth, the Kumalipo, states that indigenous Hawaiians are related to taro, a plant, right? So it's kin of theirs. And what you're taking care of from that vantage point, when you're taking care of the planet around you, is your kin. And that's a very different kind of way of relating to the planet around you and caretaking of it. And I think that's also a really important concept that runs through the book, right? We have imported, and by we, I mean as a first gen from Europe in the U.S., we have imported through colonialism a system of education that has, from Europe, that has different colleges, natural sciences, arts and humanities, and we have split all of these disciplines, but what you actually need to do is weave them together in order to, provide solutions to the climate crisis. So when I had a visiting professorship at Princeton of environmental humanities, they have this thing called the High Meadows Environmental Institute. It connects social scientists, it connects environmental scientists, it connects environmental engineers with environmental humanities faculty, precisely because they've come to recognize that you need this interdisciplinary approach. Stanford is setting up a similar kind of interdisciplinary program right now. So this is happening a lot in academia because it's recognized that this interdisciplinary approach is really important.
I want to circle back to the science, because one thing, the most obvious thing that people think about or comes to mind when you say rising sea levels, well, rising sea levels, disappearing land. But there's always a physical, chemical, and biological impact associated with rising sea levels. Obviously, the land disappears or it erodes or it sinks. But at the same time, on islands particularly, groundwater and water tables, fresh water tables can get contaminated through saltwater migration. And then there's the biological impacts to maybe estuaries or mangrove swamps who become inundated with too much saltwater because they're very sensitive to saltwater. Are you seeing the threats like that in these Pacific and Caribbean islands?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Chris. So in terms of the disappearing land and what you mentioned, either because it erodes, which is often the case for barrier islands, right. Famous examples there would be the islands off the coast of North Carolina, which are not in the book, or the islands off the coast of Alaska, which I have included one of. So barrier islands are kind of the shapeshifters of islands. The sink that you mentioned is really important. Right. Subsidence, tomato, tomato. Yeah. But I talk about subsidence a lot in the book. The main two sources of sink, which also impact cities, New Orleans famously, mm-hmm. is the extraction of too much fossil fuels or of water, water from underneath the soil for our use. And that ends up meaning that the soil compounds and everything sinks a little bit. But your question in terms of saltwater inundation with regard to islands is a really important one. Most of the islands, with rare exception that I included in Sea Change, and the exceptions I would say are Singapore and Bahrain, have really tiny economies, and they are living environmentally on a threshold, which means what? Which means that they live off of what they fish from the oceans or what they farm off the land. A lot of them, so you can look at, their economies are tiny, whether you measure that by GDP or you measure that by average salary. They also have very limited amount of rainfall. So a lot of them are highly susceptible to drought. And if you're living on a low-lying island or atoll, which is one of the two islands in the book, the other is a volcanic island or a high island. If you're living on a low-lying island or an atoll, you don't have rivers running through that island typically. Mm-hmm. And your main source of water is literally rainwater catchment. Mm-hmm. So it's the systems for collecting rain that falls from the sky, or it's freshwater aquifers, which is freshwater that hangs a little bit below the island. Now, to come back to your question of saltwater inundation's impacts, it has two main impacts. When it and they're compounded by sea level rise. When salt water gets into the freshwater aquifers, it contaminates them, or, you know, just makes them too salty. And that means too salty for humans, for plants, whether these are, you know, ones that are going to be for harvesting, for feed for humans or for animals, and then too salty for animals, whether those are, you know, free range, domesticated, or pets. And so that inundation is a real problem. It also gets into the soil, and plants can't take up salty water. No. So this saltwater inundation is a real problem.
We are speaking with Dr. Christina Gerhardt, who authored Sea Change, an Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. And I'm curious, you did include these maps in our ever-changing world. These maps are also ever-changing. I'm not sure how long it took you to pen this book, but were there changes in the maps as you were going along the way in writing this?
Is it that rapid? Yeah.
Yep. Thank you for asking about that, Claire, in terms of the trying to keep up with a topic like this that's so ever-changing in a book format. Atlas is obviously a really colonial genre. We tried to push back against it in a number of ways. And I guess this brings me back to your timeline question too. We tried to start every single timeline with an earlier marker than when Columbus sailed the ocean blue with the arrival of colonizers, the arrival of colonizers. And that was kind of tricky because a lot of the archives don't document events that predate the arrival of colonizers. The other thing, you know, that you're asking about with regard to maps, we decided to go with 2020, which is, you know, somewhere in the time of when I began this book. It's definitely a book that is a COVID book, which was wild to work on this kind of a project during peak shelter in place shutdown days. But we decided to go with 2020 for the maps. What does sea level rise look like in 2020? What does it look like in 2050? And what does it look like at the end of the year in 2100? And we went with the figures that were available at the time. But this was already an issue because we used the figures of the IPCC, the UN scientific body, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They work by consensus decision making, and what that means is everybody has to agree on the figures in the report, and then those figures, as a result, are notoriously conservative. What I mean by that is they estimate 1 foot of sea level rise by 2050 and 3 feet by 2100. But like even the U.S.'s National Climate Assessment Report estimates about 8 to 10 feet by the end of the century. So we're weighing in what Sea Change shows is a very conservative estimate of the impacts of sea level rise.
Wow. And, you know, I don't want to go too far down that cul-de-sac of conversation, but that's one of the challenges with scientists who are, by nature, quote unquote, conservative in their approach. And that not a negative impact, but can kind of have a complacent impact sometimes when you don't want to be alarmist, but sometimes you don't want to be overly conservative either. Like I say, that maybe that's a discussion for another time.
No, absolutely, Chris, that's right. I mean, look, Christina Hill, who teaches at UC Berkeley and is a hydrologist and was at my book launch last year, she almost busted out laughing at the book launch as we were on stage, as I cited these figures of 1 to 3 feet for 2050, 2100, because she knows as an IPCC contributor that those are the figures of the report, but she also knows that they're estimated to be much higher. She works on sea level rise and its impacts in the Bay Area. She works a lot on groundwater, and this is, I think, for listeners, something to think about. I had to talk to Molly Roy, the cartographer, about this. Sea level rise should not be thought of as a line approaching you at the shore. It really, the level of sea level rise, if you're living close to the waters, hangs in tandem with the groundwater level, which if you kind of think about it, you're like, oh yeah, okay, it makes sense. I guess all the water levels, you know, hang together beyond the coastline. But that means the groundwater going up because of sea level rise and pushing up everything in that groundwater, and she's looking at contamination of the soil in particular, is a really big issue, you know, for people to think about. But yeah, this, I mean, James Hansen, you know, the guy who brought, NASA, you know, NASA, the issue of the climate crisis to attention of Congress in 1988, he has also estimated this 8 to 10 feet. So whatever, you know, whatever the IPCC says, the impact, and this is not only true for sea level rise, because they cover a whole bunch of other topics in their reports, whatever they agree on, it's always going to be on the conservative side, and the impacts are going to be more dire. I focus on every chapter and close always with solutions in my teaching, every class session, in every chapter of the book, because I think it's so important to think about solutions in order to not have this topic be gloom and doom, right? Yeah. There are things we can do. We can protect coral or oyster reefs. We can, you know, protect and restore the mangroves or the wetlands. And I think, you know, this kind of work is really important. Of course, holding fossil fuel companies or ensuring that legislation gets passed to help us transition away from them is really important too.
And you do center the Islander voices. You talked to them and you interviewed them. What was that process like? And was there a common thread, or did you have certain questions that you asked everyone, and did they have some common thread answers?
I interviewed, for every chapter, I interviewed hundreds of Islanders. Mm. So scientists, you know, ministers of environment, climate envoys to the UN talks, local NGO reps, and then local farmers and fisher folks, and just ask them about the impacts. It's super, I mean, as I'm trying to center the voices of frontline communities, it's super important to recognize that there is protocol of asking for permission for certain information from indigenous Islanders to be shared, as well as Caribbean, Black Caribbean Islanders. And I think a certain amount of sensitivity needs to be shown there, that one is trying to be an ally or trying to support whatever their initiatives are. So one doesn't come in with a top-down approach, but rather one is really trying to see, you know, what their wishes, needs, desires are, and to advocate or to put those out there. So the solutions that are being undertaken that I mentioned previously and that are included in the book are often ones that are being put forward by Islanders themselves because there is lacking financial support from the international community, which is, you know, the Global North, again, responsible for these impacts. And they just haven't been, you know, putting forward the money at the UN that they've been promising since 2009. I've written about this for The Nation. I mean, they promised in 2009 $200 billion a year, the Global North did, for nations in the Global South to deal with some of these impacts like sea level rise. And that money just has not been on the table. And that's, I mean, that's a long stretch of time by now. And so, you know, Islanders are just taking action themselves. So I wanted to also foreground that kind of work and the initiatives that they were already pursuing.
Wow, 2009. That's 15 years. And let's say a foot of water in that way. I don't mean to laugh, but that's, you can equate it to those things. What is the holdup?
That's a really great question. Okay, I mean, I will say from last year's UN negotiations, one of the things that was finally put forward was the Loss and Damages Fund. Some of your listeners may be familiar, and if they're not, it is kind of what it sounds like. It is a demand by nations in the Global South to create a fund, a funding mechanism for nations from the Global North to pay for loss, which is anything that's been irrecoverably lost, or damages. So things, you know, as it sounds, that are damaged but could be repaired. That's a separate funding mechanism in addition to the one that I mentioned previously. And they have been working on that since, you know, for 30 years, since the very first UN climate conference in Rio in 1992. So, you know, that took 30 years. That was passed, not last year, but the year before. That took, you know, 30 years to get across the finish line. Nations in the Global North are dragging their heels. And you know, that accountability is really important to push for, meaning, you know, that they actually take some action on this.
Yeah, and do you think bringing to light or writing a book like yours can help shed light on the real plight of the people that are dealing with this sea level rise in a very impactful and dire way?
I mean, my hope is that chapters of it will be adopted by educators at all levels. They're short. They're like 2 to 3 pages, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, my hope is that this is at once simple enough that, you know, high school teachers, community college educators, university professors can adopt some of this in order to open up into a more robust discussion of the issues in one of the chapters. It's definitely a book written with modern attention span and the internet in mind, in that the chapters are short, but there's also a very webby structure to the book. It's not meant to be read sequentially. You can do that. You can read it from cover to cover, but it really encourages and rewards island hopping. So, you know, one can bounce from one chapter to another. There's a meta structure to the entire thing where, as a pedagogue, I know that if you repeat something a couple times, it's great because people get it by the second or third time. If you repeat it way too many times, it just, you know, drones on and it becomes boring. And so there are certain terms that are underlined, like subsidence or rainwater catchment, that appear a couple of times in the book, but not repeatedly. I could have used both of those terms for probably at least half of the islands. But so that was also the trick, finding out, because my editor said, well, 49 islands, isn't that going to be kind of boring? Aren't they all the same? And I was stunned by the comment because it just kind of totally steamrolled over all of the unique histories and languages of each of the islands. But it indicated to me that I really needed to make sure that the unique aspect of each island is pushed to the fore. Yeah. So I went to the public library and picked up a stack of books one day. I always feel really proud when the librarians are impressed by what you pick out. Yeah. And they were books on animals specific to islands that were extinct. And then there was another book on the boats of islands around the world. So I was really looking to highlight what was very particular. And so there are a lot of creatures in the book. I was inspired there by Amy Nazuka Matatil's World of Wonders, which is a magical book about creatures that your listeners might be familiar with. And if they're not, I really recommend checking it out. Yeah. But there's also beautiful books on you know, navigating, which oceanic navigating in the Pacific has a long history. I also highlighted the history of navigating. There's an Arabic, you know, history of navigating in the Middle East. And then there's a very strong and deep history of navigating from China. Right. And so, you know, these are the kinds of things that I was also trying to push forward.
And the vantage point that you show of each of these maps, is there a specific vantage point that you were taking?
The vantage point of the maps is not very decolonial in terms of the majority of the ones in the book, and I'm cognizant of that. It is the bird's eye point of view, so the directly above point of view. We talked about lateral shots. We also talked about whether or not to include photographs in the book, and we decided not to in order to give it this classical sort of 19th century feel. The colors of the book, the blue of the maps and the yellow of the cover, those are classical colors of the atlas. So there's a lot of tradition there, but then we wove in counter mapping, if you will. We included indigenous maps. Wooden maps are included after Greenland, and then we included some stick charts from the Marshall Islands, which map swells and currents, and they're made of bamboo tied together with twine. So,
so
very different kinds of maps.
Yeah. Well, we do have to leave it at that. We have to wrap up. But Dr. Christina Gerhardt, thank you so much for coming to the show. The book is called Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. We appreciate you being on the show.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Gerhardt.
Great to be with you.